This is Hidden Killers Half Year in Review. A look back at some of the most compelling cases of 2026 so far. This is Hidden Killers with Tony Bruschi. Here now, Tony Bruschi.
For 3 weeks, she sat at the defense table, kind of like a statue. That's not editorial, that's the word a juror used. A juror who watched Corey Richens every single day of that trial told ABC's Good Morning America that Corey barely moved, barely reacted. A small smile here and there when she leaned in towards her attorneys. Otherwise, nothing. As far as what she saw, no fear, no grief, no visible scene where the performance ended and the real person began. 42 witnesses, 3 weeks of testimony about secret insurance policies, a housekeeper who sold her pills at a gas station, phone searches for how much fentanyl it takes to kill a man, a statue. And then Judge Richard Marzik read the word guilty. Corey Richens bowed her head, started breathing heavily. So here's where this is actually added, and here's where this is actually about. Not the verdict itself, because you already know the verdict, but what broke in that moment? What is the lie finally catching up with her? Was it something closer to relief? The performance finally over? Or was it neither of those things? Was it simply the recognition that the story needed a new chapter? That she was already thinking about how to write it? Because if you've been paying attention to Corey Richens, you know one thing above everything else. This woman does not stop writing. You have to understand what she built before you can understand what a guilty verdict means to someone like her. Eric Richens died on March 4th of 2022 in the home he shared with his wife and their three young boys outside of Park City, Utah. 5 times a lethal dose of fentanyl in his system. The medical examiner determined it was illicit street drugs, not prescription, ingested orally. The only adults in that house were Eric and Corey. Within a year of his death, Corey had written a children's book, Are You With Me?, dedicated to her amazing husband that she was cheating on and poisoning. She took it to local television. She sat in front of a camera and described navigating the first holidays without him, his birthday, their anniversary. She said writing it brought her peace. She said it gave her and her boy something to work towards. Except she didn't write any of it. She told Carmen Lauber, her housekeeper, the woman prosecutors say sold her the fentanyl pills, that Eric died of a brain aneurysm. When she was arrested in May of 23, she sat down with Dateline NBC because she just couldn't resist and said on camera, this means war. Not grief, not disbelief, war. And her mother, Lisa Darden, sent the grief book to the Summit County Sheriff's Office anonymously, wrote a note declaring it proof of the true Corey, a devoted wife and adoring mother. It matters more than it might seem, because this was never a solo performance. Corey Richens didn't just carry a story. She built a production around it, a published book, television appearances, a supporting cast that included her own mother mailing anonymous packages to people investigating her daughter for murder. This wasn't one person maintaining a lie in private. This was an entire machine built to generate and distribute a particular version of reality. A guilty verdict now has to contend with that machine, not just with one woman in a courtroom. The most important thing about this verdict got the least attention. That jury did not want to find her guilty. They did, but they didn't want to. Let's talk about that. And while we do, give me your thoughts in the comment section on YouTube and Substack. The links are in the description. Juror Laura said it directly on day one. She felt sympathy for Corey. She saw a woman sitting alone at that desperate table while the prosecution laid out its case against her. She said she initially thought Corey herself felt trapped. The jury, in Laura's own words, was really sad because they did not want it to be true. They walked into that deliberation room actively looking for a reason not to convict. Despite the mountain of evidence, they wanted the defense's version to hold up. Sloppy investigation, biased detectives, a husband with a secret drug habit nobody knew about. They wanted reasonable doubt to give them a way out because they knew she had kids. They cared about those kids far more than Corey Richens cared about her own kids. But sometimes the evidence is just so damning that you gotta do what you gotta do. They deliberated for 3 hours. After a three-week trial, after 42 witnesses, after forensic evidence, digital records, and a housekeeper's testimony that put the drugs directly in Corey's hands, 8 people who extended every possible benefit of the doubt and still couldn't find a door out, the evidence didn't just beat reasonable doubt. It beat wishful thinking. It beat the genuine human desire of 8 strangers to believe something better about someone they'd been watching for weeks. And through every minute of it, Corey sat there like a statue. No crack in the performance, no moment where something real showed through and gave the jurors something to hold on to. They were looking. They needed that moment, and they didn't find it. Which brings us to the appeals and why the appellate courts and what the appellate courts maybe are able to do and what they're going to face. Which is a whole lot of the exact same problem. Sentencing is set for May 13th. After that, her attorneys have 30 days to file a notice of appeal. The case should move to the Utah Court of Appeals or the Utah Supreme Court. There are potential grounds. The defense has sought to move the trial out of Summit County to Salt Lake County, that a request was denied. They filed multiple motions for mistrial throughout the proceedings. There were evidentiary rulings they objected to along the way. But here's the problem. Judge Marzik was careful in the way that experienced judges are careful when they know an appeal is coming. When Corey waived her right to testify, and when the defense rested without calling a single witness, the judge looked her directly in the eye and had her confirm both discussions on the record. He was methodically closing off appellate arguments before they could be planted. Former prosecutors who've analyzed the record say the standard is brutal. It's not enough to argue the judge got something wrong. You have to argue he got it so wrong that the outcome might have been different. With this volume and weight of evidence, that's a very hard argument to make. Best case scenario for Corey Richens is a new trial years from now. And she still has 26 financial felonies pending in a separate case. Oh, yes. So it's kind of one of those, it's kind of Murdaugh-y in a way, where even if by some amazing hand of God reaching down and changing this up, if she gets a Becky Hill like Alec Murdaugh did, which we still don't know how that's even all going to end or play out. So let's go to the Supreme Court. Even if she's still got those 26 financial felonies pending in a separate case. Mortgage fraud, money laundering, bad checks, a pattern of unlawful activities filed in June 25. No trial date set yet. That case isn't going anywhere. She is, by any honest accounting, looking at decades for her actions. But the legal calendar is almost besides the point, because the more haunting question is what a guilty verdict actually does to someone like Corey Richens on the inside. There are two real possibilities. The first is relief. Did you see her mugshot? She looks a little relieved. It sounds counterintuitive until you think about what the maintenance of a lie this size actually costs. Every day, for years, you are tracking what you told which person, monitoring what the investigation might have uncovered, performing grief publicly while privately holding the truth of how that grief got manufactured. The children's book alone. Sitting down to write a dedication to your amazing husband, doing television interviews about healing and peace and navigating the holidays without him. That takes a particular kind of sustained psychological effort that's almost impossible to comprehend from the outside. When the verdict comes and the performance is over, some people in that position find something that resembles rest. Not peace, not freedom, just the end of having to be the other person. The lie doesn't have to be maintained anymore. A terrible ending is still an ending, and endings can feel like exhaling. But then there's the second possibility, and this is the one that keeps me up at night. People who have built their entire identity around a false narrative don't release it when confronted with proof it's false. They dig deeper. The more the lie has become who they are and who they believe they are, the more a direct challenge, even a
unanimous jury verdict actually tightens their grip on the story. It's not stubbornness in an ordinary sense. It's something closer to survival. Admitting the truth doesn't just mean admitting to a crime. It means the total collapse of a self that was constructed around not having committed it. For Corey Richens, that self was public. It had a publisher. It had a television appearance. It had a mother who sent anonymous packages defending it to the sheriff. You don't just walk away from that. Not easily. Maybe not ever. And here's where two specific pieces of writing tell you everything. First piece, Are You With Me? The children's grief book, written in the year after Eric's death, dedicated to the husband prosecutors say she poisoned, published and promoted while she allegedly knew exactly how he died. There's a second piece, a six-page letter found in Corey's jail cell in September of 23, apparently scripting testimony for her brother, instructing him to tell her former attorney that Eric had confided in him about getting fentanyl from Mexico and using it every night. Her defense said it was fiction that she was working on. The prosecution called it a guilty conscience, building another cover story. Two pieces of writing, two separate moments when the narrative needed shoring up. The same instinct each time? When the story's at risk, construct something. Put it on paper. Make it real by writing it down. This is not the behavior of someone who experiences a guilty verdict as a reckoning. This is the behavior of someone already working on the next draft. And remember, she wasn't doing it alone. Her mother sent that book anonymously to the sheriff's office and called it proof that the real Corey, the false narrative, had believers, promoters, people who had stalked or staked something on it. A jury verdict doesn't dissolve that infrastructure. If anything, it gives the next chapter an audience. The grieving widow has become the wrongfully convicted mother. Same character, different chapter. And when you talk like Donna Adelson, it makes it all the more dramatic. Go back to what the jury saw. Eight people who wanted to believe her, who spent 3 weeks hoping the evidence would have handed them a reason to vote the other way. They watched her every day and couldn't find a single crack. No seam, no moment where something real and unguarded showed through. They were looking for it. They needed it and they didn't get it. That is not innocence under pressure. That is something else entirely. And whatever it is, it will carry her through the appeals, through the financial crimes trial, through every new chapter the legal system writes for her. Not as legal strategy. As a way of being. Sentencing is May 13th. That would have been Eric Richens' 44th birthday. Whether the court's calendar landed there by coincidence or design, it sits like a quiet final punctuation mark on a story that's been anything but quiet. On the day his family would have been celebrating his life, a judge will decide how many years get taken away from his wife. His sister Amy wept in that courtroom the night the verdict came in. She said it had been a long time coming, said they could finally focus on honoring Eric's life and supporting his boys. His boys, their boys. Three kids, roughly 13, 11, and 9 now, who grew up inside the story Corey told, who had that book in their home, maybe read to them, maybe on a shelf where they could see it, who were handed a version of their father's death that 8 strangers just formally rejected. They'll carry all of it. The original story, the true story, and the distance between the two for the rest of their lives. That's not a legal consequence. That's just the weight of what was done. 3 hours. 3 years of Corey Richens maintaining her story, the book, the television appearances, her mother's anonymous packages, the letters from jail, and 8 people who walked into that deliberation room hoping she was innocent, needed 3 hours to dismantle all of it. She said, "This means war." And she meant it. The appeals will come. The legal machine will keep turning. New chapters will get written because that is what she does. That is what she's always done. When the story needs protecting, she picks up a pen. And guess what? They have pens in prison. But on May 13th, a judge will look at her across the courtroom on what would have been her husband's 44th birthday. And whatever she's writing in her head in that moment, whatever the next chapter looks like to her, the sentence is going to be the same. Some lies outlast the courtroom. Some people carry them all the way to the end. What will Corey do? Give me your thoughts in the comment section on Substack and YouTube. Love to read those, and we'll continue our conversation right there. The links are in the description. Be sure to press subscribe wherever you're getting podcasts as well. Apple Podcasts, Spotify, iHeart, whatever it is. Hit subscribe. Leave us a review there on Apple Podcasts. We do greatly appreciate that. Until next time, I'm Tony Bruschi. We'll talk again real soon.
Want more on this case and others? Then press subscribe now and don't miss a moment of true crime coverage from Tony Bruschi and the Hidden Killers podcast. This is Hidden Killers Live with Tony Bruschi and Robin Dree.
Let's wrap up here now that we have a verdict in the Corey Richens case. We haven't had a chance, Jen, to have you on since the verdict came in. Summit County jury has found Corey Richens guilty of murdering her husband, Eric, with that lethal dose of fentanyl. No murder weapon recovered because there was fentanyl. The star witness shredded on the stand. The defense called zero witnesses. Didn't really matter. Now we ask what this verdict actually means for Eric's kids, for everyone who followed this case, and for what comes next now that the cameras are going away. Jen, what was your reaction to the verdict here on this? I'm just going to open it up very broadly on that after we watched Corey give her faces throughout the trial, her interesting reactions to folks, and then eventually no witnesses called. She chose not to testify and then found guilty. What's your thoughts?
Well, and I think Monday you posed the question to both Robin and I, would she be found guilty? And
yeah.
Robin and I both agreed she would be, because this is a strong circumstantial case.
Mm-hmm.
She was. So no surprise. I think that they got it right. What I did think was interesting, and I don't know if you've seen it, but the jury foreperson was interviewed.
Yeah.
I haven't seen it, but I've heard of it. Yes.
Yeah, it was good.
I love this interview. Because they didn't want to convict her.
Yeah.
Yeah.
The mother, she's got two little kids. She looked like Little House on the Prairie school marm. I don't know. They did not want to convict her. But they knew they had to, because the evidence, you know, they kept their emotion out of it and looked at the evidence. This is such a tragedy. The kids, no mom, no dad. Forever knowing that your mom murdered your dad. It's just, it's so horrible. I mean, this is just one of these cases that's horrible. And at the end of the day, Corey Richens had the life by the cojones.
Yeah.
And she made all these decisions that just were a train wreck for her children. So really, who I think about are the people left behind, the mom, the dad, everybody who loved Eric, but mostly the children. Ugh, horrible.
The thing that keeps striking me about this case, because every time we're looking at different angles of this, whether it's from the interviews that she did for the book, and I know I'm kind of sounding like a broken record on this, but as well as in the courtroom itself, no matter who was put on the stand, no matter what topic was brought up, she gave no emotional response to anything or anyone unless it directly related to her. And so it just, her nonverbals were screaming how self-centered she was, because everything kept coming back to her. It was just so profound. And it was, you know, it was interesting because Bob Mata, when he's talking about, you know, they didn't deliberate. I really liked what the foreperson said, because, yeah, they were in there a short amount of time, but I really loved how they kind of dismissed that idea of not deliberation or having a foregone conclusion, because I loved how she said they were trying to find her innocent because they felt such compassion for the family. So good on them.
Which is interesting, because the kids were barely brought up in the trial.
I know.
And that is like such the key element to this. It's interesting that the jury didn't need anybody to hold their hand and take them there to that point and go, like, this is a mother of three kids too, by the way.
She didn't look like one.
Like, it could have been like, what if you're to look back on this, if you're Corey Richens and you're to go, how could I have handled this differently in court? How should my counsel have handled this? What would you say, Jen? How do you think she could have handled it differently? Maybe producing a slightly different outcome.
First of all, number one, and I don't know why they styled her that way. And yeah. I'm going to call it styled.
Yeah, someone said that too.
Fake. And so, you know, presumptive. I would have had her style herself like she was. Mm-hmm. And she's actually really cute and attractive, and you never know if that could have caused somebody, oh my gosh, she looks like my daughter, or she looks like my sister. But the presentation they made was just so out there. Number two, and I said this at the time, she needed to take the stand. I probably wouldn't have said that as a lawyer. I would have said, listen, not a good idea. But knowing the evidence that existed, I would have said, you got one Hail Mary. Might as well get up there.
Yeah.
What case was it, Tony? And Jen, you might remember too. I'm not sure. I don't think it was the Adelsons, but maybe. We've covered cases where they've taken a stand, or at least it's been brought up, that the impact of her being put in jail on the kids. And they didn't do that. I mean, it was just really, there was emotional cords they could have really, because this was an emotional case. It was a, you know, it was a circumstantial case, which gives you the opportunity to pull on emotional cords. I know, and I was watching the string, the comments we had when I mentioned even the fact that she wasn't wearing a wedding ring and it would have come across as fraudulent if she did with a boyfriend. But at the same time, it has that subliminal impact. If she had wedding rings she's playing with, the change, like to Jen's point, the change of her look, having her hair down instead of being the stark, you know, pulled back into a bun. There's a lot of things I think they could have done behaviorally to soften that blow, to make her empathetic as a mother and taking and put away a mother from her kids that they didn't even bring up.
In emotion. Why didn't they, fake or not? I'm just saying, if you're saying how to get somebody off,
yeah,
you should be emotional during this. Your yeah. husband is dead. Your husband of, what were they, 9 years married?
Yeah.
Father of your children, could they not find any way for this woman to have some sort of?
She looked like she was more inconvenienced being there than anything else, and that I think really read to the jury, just very very plainly. I'm wondering if at sentencing, if more of that will be brought up. How do you think sentencing is going to play for Corey Richens? Because now we've confirmed everything. We've confirmed. I mean, and it is monstrous as shit. Just what she did. Where you look at it all, and it's all confirmed. The lies, the manipulation, the trying to change. Like, she did this to Eric, and then she tries to like retell the history, the story of Eric as something completely different than it is. She just continues to dig and dig and dig and dig after she did it. How do you think that's going to be looked at when it comes to the sentencing? Is the judge going to throw the book at her and be like, you did, look, you showed no remorse. You showed no empathy. You looked inconvenienced just being here. You're done completely. We're not even going to talk about any sort of getting out at any point in time. There's no option for it. Or do you think there's some grace given at some point, just strictly because there are three children? Or does the judge say, you know what, the best thing for these kids is this woman never seeing them again?
I'm just going to comment on what I would do.
Yeah.
25 to life is what she's looking at. I give her life. People aren't going to like this. I would give her life, but I actually would give the possibility of parole.
Mm-hmm.
Why? Because I would know she's never going to make the parole. She's going to mess up everywhere. There's no chance. But I would do that because of the kids. I would do that to give their kids a glimmer of hope, that maybe mommy would get out. So that's what I would do, because I'm an empath.
Is that cruel, though, to the kids in a certain way? Because in every so many years, mom might get out. But again, that's also assuming that the kids want mom to get out. I'm guessing, at some point, you know, they're going to be adults by the time that happens, that they might not necessarily have any fond or favorable opinion of mom, and mom might already be mentally dead to them.
And you're right. And mom might be, I don't know. That's just what I would do.
Yeah.
I think she'll screw up so bad behind bars. By the way, I think she'll do very good behind bars. I think she'll be like a Lori Vallow and running.
Yeah, we thought same thing.
I think she'll actually do well behind bars, but I think she'll probably, you know, drink from the toilet, you know.
So here's my question. Do we know the law where she's at? Can she profit from this behind bars? Because you know there's going to be a Netflix on her.
It's Utah.
The son, no. So okay. I remember I looked into this. The Son of Sam, there are no exact Son of Sam laws exactly like that, but there are laws that prohibit her from making money off of it because, yes, I'm
okay.
Sure that there is something in place that she can't profit.
All right, and actually, this is and Tony. We didn't get to this one, but I wanted to cover it. It was one of the listeners because it's on the same theme. One of the listeners had written in about what about the book and the proceeds from the book. Where does that go? I looked it up. So the book is actually no longer for sale. The publisher suspended it. And regardless, from the point she was convicted, all assets were frozen for restitution. So there's no way she would have made money on it anywhere, or anyone could make money on it because it's off the shelf.
At the end of the day, I don't think people realize how little people make off of books either. And I can't imagine.
I know.
I can't imagine that this was a highly profitable book.
it'll be interesting, Jen, because even though she can't make money, whether she is or not, I don't, at this point, she doesn't need it because she's like, "Ooh, I'm in jail. I'm out of debt finally."
I wonder how, honest to God, I wonder how, you know, that mugshot that we saw of her, she looked relieved.
I'm out of debt.
And I wonder how much of it is just a relief at this point. But,
unfortunately, this is what I really don't like. You see me get like, she's going to get to control a narrative for whoever does her story behind bars. And so potentially in there. So I think we're going to see something because she's going to revel in that. And I think to Jen's point, she will thrive behind bars because of controlling narratives. But I did have one moment. There's one moment that I really, really, really liked during the end of the trial because she wasn't given much except relating to herself. But did everyone see how heavily she was breathing when the jury, when they're reading the verdict? She was under such stress because you could see and feel that heart pounding, you know, in her chest. And that made me feel really, really good because the heart is pounding with that anticipation. And then the bomb dropped. That was just a great moment because she, as little empathy as she has for anyone else, she has great empathy for herself, which is called narcissism. So it just, when that, you could see her heart explode at the disappointment. That was a great moment.
I wonder if she was surprised. Do you think she was surprised by the verdict?
It looked it, didn't it?
Yeah. She was still believing her own.
She was hopeful. She looked hopeful. I think she looked hopeful.
Narcissism is neat. It's insane to watch because it's like, wow, you really believe this. That's really impressive that you believe this. That's amazing.
Yeah, heaving. Good word, hey, Mona. She was heaving. You're right. That's a good word.
My God. All right. Your guys' thoughts in the comment section on Substack and YouTube. Love to get them. Be sure to press subscribe wherever you're downloading podcasts so you don't miss any of our coverage of this and the many cases that we follow for you right here. As always, thank you guys. Robin's new book, it is out this week. It's not, oop, there goes my keys. It's Not All About Me. Available wherever books are sold. Go and check that out. Until next time, for Jennifer Coffendaffer, Robin Drake and Todd, I'm Tony Bruschi. We'll talk again real soon.
Want more on this case and others? Then press subscribe now and don't miss a moment of true crime coverage from Tony Bruschi and the Hidden Killers podcast.
Here's what happened when one journalist reported on DEI programs.
I decided to just focus on the University of Michigan. I obtained internal documents that showed that the school had spent about $250 million on DEI programs. I spent 2 weeks in Ann Arbor talking to everybody I could find. The unintended consequences of these programs, they had sort of left everybody dissatisfied. And this expensive machinery the school had built just imploded. If you're a journalist, you are not on anyone's team. All you're trying to do is figure out as many of the facts as you can gather. The facts are going to guide you to where the story lands. You're not taking sides. I'm Nick Confessori. I'm an investigations reporter for the New York Times.
Journalists like Nick follow the facts wherever they lead. They go where news breaks, get answers firsthand, and publish what they find. That's fact-based reporting. Seek it out if you don't already.